Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Hey, this is Jeff Chang. Can't stop, won't stop. Listening to Rebel Radio with Josh Levine. Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine. This week, we bring you part one of a two-part episode with the authors of Can't Stop, Won't Stop, the Young Adult Edition, Jeff Chang and Davey D. Cook. They're DJs, academics, activists. Jeff was a founder of the Soul Sides crew, which brought us artists like DJ Shadow, Blackalicious, Lyrics Born. Davey D is a Bay Area underground hero. He's been on the air for many, many years on KPFA community radio, as well as he's well known for his charts that we talk about, and he runs hiphopandpolitics.com. This book is one of my favorite books that I've read recently, and probably my favorite thing I've ever read about hip hop. It is a chronicle of hip hop history from day one into the present, extremely comprehensive and detailed. And it not only talks about the music and the artists, but also the political and cultural context for hip hop becoming this global movement. You know, we think of hip hop as the story, at least I think of hip hop as the American dream come true, as well as America's nightmare. And ultimately it's the story of creativity and drive overcoming adversity. And this book digs into pivotal moments in hip hop's evolution that illustrate that point. So I encourage you to dig in on this one. We're going to come back next week with part two, not only talking about some of the lessons that the guys learned, you know, uncovered in writing the book, but also what they learned in their process of putting it together. It's a great interview, and I hope you enjoy it. Let's go. A little bit. I want to talk about the book, which I put up behind us. Can't Stop, Won't Stop. It's dope. I'm midway through it. Really enjoying it. Mm-hmm. And you know, I want to talk about all of it and go back a little bit into both of your history. You know, we've all known each other a long time. Jeff, I owe you a big debt that you moving to the Bay got me my job at Herb when I was first graduating college. You know, I think I had been writing for them freelance.
Oh, yeah.
And then I happened to graduate right at the time that you were quitting that job. And so there was a spot for me. And that was one of those days that changed my life.
Oh, it's a beautiful thing, man. It's such a beautiful thing. And you did a hell of a job, man, with that, and now with all your work that you're doing, all your businesses and stuff.
Thanks, man. It's funny, you know, how this, like, I don't know, you know, for me, there's this community that, you know, just moving through it, for me, it's been like one step after another, you know, man. Like, somehow or another, you know, I met Dave Paul.
Yep.
You know, that led to meeting, you know, whoever else. And then, you know, somehow you and I met, and that led to, you know, other things. And it's, I always say, you know, every good thing that's come to me, definitely professionally, but I think personally too, it's just been the result of relationships.
Yeah, for
sure. And knowing the right people, that's a big part of it.
I love that we're still able to build like this, you know, all these years later. And
for sure,
you know, just seeing what you've been able to do is just it's so great. It's so beautiful.
I appreciate it. What about you two? Before we get into the too deep with it, obviously you guys have known each other a long time. How'd you come together to work on this project?
We, you know, the book came out, the original book came out in 2005, and I was blessed enough for the book to kind of have a life and to get out there and that kind of thing over the years. One of the greatest, you know, me and Dave's books were supposed to come out at about the same time. I always felt like if that had happened then, man, like it just would have been so amazing and so powerful. And so, you know, my editor, who's just a brilliant woman, Monique Patterson, came back to me about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and was like, you know, we need to make the book available for a new generation. And so I was like, man, you know, we get another chance at this. That's great. So I first person I called up was Dave and was like,
nice.
Let's do this. Let's let's really, really make this happen. And I was lucky enough for him to say yes. So
that's cool.
Here we are.
That's very cool. Well, yeah. You guys have, you know, both such great histories as DJs, as journalists, as college professors, social activists, you know, I think a lot of parallels. So I want to dig into the history a little bit, if you indulge me. And I always like to kind of start at the very beginning. So I'm gonna ask both of you, do you remember the first record you ever bought?
Oh. Mm-hmm. First record I bought was Trans Europe Express.
Okay.
No. The first record I had bought for me with my parents picked up Trans Europe Express. The first record that I personally went and bought was Computer Games by Yellow Magic Orchestra.
Oh, nice.
That's the first breakbeat that I bought. And I still have that, believe it or not.
Sure.
And then, you know, I got a bunch of other records, you know, from Downstairs Records and all that. Mm-hmm. And I had a pretty healthy collection of breakbeats, which, interestingly enough, was stolen at Marcy Projects.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So the story goes like this. I was in a crew, and the crew was based in Marble Hill in the Promenade in the Riverdale section of the Bronx next to Kennedy High. And there was a guy who was called himself Jazzy J2, and Arthur Marklin, Artie Art, and our DJ was Steve, who lived in Marcy. And they had the crew go out there and do a gig. And they did a gig, and it was great. And they borrowed my records. You know, they had my breakbeats. And when the party was over, they got stuck. They got stuck up by people who were at the party. And the way it went in New York at that time, the fly way of robbing somebody was to be gracious and give them money to get on the subway. So it's literally like they robbed the crew and made them take off their shoes in the winter and thanked them for the party. And then in an act of being gracious, gave everybody, you know, like a dollar or something like that to get on the subway. And so that was
that's almost like more insulting.
Yeah. So my records were gone. So at the time, we had a couple of people that weren't there that night that were members of Zulu, you know, and they went back to Brooklyn to get the equipment. Mm-hmm. Now, they came back with equipment. I don't know if it was the equipment that was stolen, but I never got my records back. And for a long, long time, when you mentioned Brooklyn, I would just be like, you know, shake my head. And when you mentioned Marcy Projects, there was like, there was always this thing like, and then, you know, of course you get somebody like Jay-Z years later, Marcy. And he would say it and I would always cringe because I really had, I mean, I have the list of all those records that I had because sure, I put them in my rhyme book. Yeah. And it was just an impressive, like I had some records. And the only reason, like some of the other ones, like my computer games didn't get stolen, was because those were albums and I mm-hmm. didn't give those albums. They had all my 45s, you know, so I still have my original copy of I Just Want to Do My Thing. Still have that one by Edwin Starr. Computer mm-hmm. games. I have my Trans Europe Express. I think I have, do I have a copy of Jam on the Groove? I still have that one. Mm. But all that other stuff, single copies, Downstairs Records, Ear Hustling. Sure. Yeah, you know, because you had to know the names mm-hmm. of the records. So you're standing there in the corner and it might be somebody like Flash in there. And, you know, and you're trying to hear, like, what's the name? What song's he getting in? You'd be like, oh, I want Ring My Bells. It's like, oh, okay. What record you want, Youngblood? Ring My Bells. Okay. And then you get home and it's like Anita Ward's Ring My Bells. Like, not a breakbeat, you know? So
that's so
how
funny.
That was. Yeah.
Wow. Jeff, what about you?
Well, I can't top that story at all. I've heard parts of that story, but I knew about the Zulus going back to Brooklyn part of the story, but I hadn't heard the whole story. That's a dope story, Dave.
That's cool.
Sorry you had to live through that. But it actually explains why.
Well, I wasn't there. I personally didn't experience the trauma.
Oh, the you trauma didn't. Yeah. It was just the records being taken.
Yeah, because I didn't go that night.
Yeah.
Just the records, yeah.
Just the records being taken. But I'd never heard that particular story. I grew up in Hawaii. So, you know, we had a lot of AM radio type stuff. And so, you know, came up with stuff like they played a lot of War and a lot of Earth, Wind & Fire and stuff like that. And I feel like probably the first albums that we probably bought or I probably bought were like the K-Tel records that would have like a bunch of different tracks on. I think I might even still have the first one that I had. It had like Misdemeanor on it by Foster Silvers.
Okay.
Like Bay City Rollers and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like a mix of different folks. Tie a Yellow Ribbon. I was on that one too. I just know because that's the one album I used to listen over and over again. But the first full album I probably really bought was Earth, Wind & Fire's Spirit, because I really liked Saturday Night, that one song, Saturday Night. And I was a kid, and just, you know, that just fired my imagination. So those would be probably the first two that I really remember.
I mean, there was definitely something to that, you know, those early records that, you know, you just used to spend so much time with those records, reading them, looking at them, playing them over and over. You know, it was crazy. And it's such a, like, it seems like such a distance from the experience we have today with music. Just, you know, always at our fingertips and all that.
But, you know, you go, I spend a lot of time digging, but digital digging.
Sure.
And there's an art to it, and there's an enjoyment, you know. You know, like last night I spent about 2 hours going through all of Tall Black Brothers catalog, you know, and finding like his early stuff and going on Bandcamp and tracking down remixes, you know, and, you know, and then trying to find records that he may have used and that. And so it is what you make it. I mean, sure, you know, I didn't have to go to 15 different record stores.
Right.
You know, and I have software to grab some of it and I pay for some of it. And, you know, and then you might even add your own flavor to it. But it was a good 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the night out of my time, you know, listening to stuff and trying to discover it. And then also thinking, like, how am I going to apply this? Like, when I get off the show, I'm definitely going to be, you know, going in the mix and trying to place those records together. And that's a fun thing.
Sure.
You know, it's better than having to be on the subway, go to the bus, go to the other store. You only got one copy of that record. I need the second one. You got to go to another city.
That's right.
And then you got to come back and catalog the records and then play them. You know, we save time.
Yeah. So, no, you're absolutely right. And there's, you know, I think there's a difference between what we used to have to do and what we can choose to do. Right. And it's, you know, there's no,
You know, no one's mad, I think, at the convenience of not having to do everything you just said. But yeah. I also think, like, you know, we sometimes we trade off some experiences that we might be giving up in the meantime.
What experiences? What do you feel we're missing?
Well, look, I think most people don't do what you just talked about. Right. And I think, you know, for kids coming up today, I know, you know, for me, probably you guys that, you know, 8, 10 years old up to, you know, mid-20s, you're just like, music is everything. And you're constantly looking for that new record, or, you know, that was a lot of what your friendships are based on. And, you know, I had this homeboy, I just connected with my best friend from fifth grade on Facebook. And we hadn't spoken since like eighth grade. Every Friday we used to sit there and make our top 10 list from the tracks we heard on KMEL, KSOL. Yeah. Right. And so it was just, you know, so that thing of like, you're saving up your money. So to answer your question, Dave, right? Like, you're saving up your money to get that, those one or two new releases that came out on a Tuesday. You had to get there. Like you were talking about, you had to know to ask for them, or you had to be cool with the dude behind the counter that would kind of help you through that. You had to, you know, a lot of times you couldn't listen to it before you got it home, right? So you had to kind of take on faith from the cover or from what label it was on or whatever you knew about it. And, you know, on the one hand, like, that's a terrible inconvenience. It's a not an efficient way to spend your time at all. On the other hand, like, that scarcity, we all know the psychology of that, right? Scarcity creates attraction, right? And the fact that you had something that everybody didn't have made it meaningful. The fact that you couldn't get it because maybe it was sold out, or you didn't have the money that week, or whatever those things are, that creates meaning in our lives. And so I'm not saying that it's not a good or bad thing, right? But I am saying, like, when we trade those things away, we give up certain things with it, right? Mm-hmm. And so the flip side to me is, like, I can listen to any song I want to right now as soon as I think of it. It's in my phone.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that's brilliant. Like, I started a playlist about a year ago that's because I wake up most mornings with a song playing in my head. It's always something different. Sometimes it's something I don't like. Sometimes it's something I love. And I just was like, I'm going to add it to a playlist, like, instantly when I wake up, like, oh, that's that song, right? And that's super fun. And you can never do that, you know, without this kind of easy access. So it's not, I'm not saying it's good or bad. It just changes, I think, our relationship to music.
Well, you know, the flip side to that is that there was a group of people probably on a podcast like this, Josh, if there was a podcast back in the days, with folks going, these boys don't know what they're missing. Now, when we came up,
for sure,
Jeff played the trombone, you know, Dave played the piano, and Josh played the drums.
That's right.
And that's how we bonded, because we were actually in a band. And those folks were like, these kids got it easier. They're just buying records. We have to make the music.
I know you can't get enough of Rebel Radio. Check us out over on the Stereo app. I'm doing a series of live social conversations with some guests I've had on this show, as well as some other friends. We're calling it Trade Secrets, where we're uncovering career and business tips that you can use today in your lives. They're short conversations, and the cool thing about it is you can join in, you can leave comments, ask questions, be part of the conversation with us. Go to stereo.com/rebelradionet, follow us along, and I hope you'll join us there. Know, so much of our relationship to music, to whatever, is generational. It has to do with what's happening in our lives at the time, or what's happening in the greater cultural context at the time, right? And, you know, there's a generation gap in hip hop, you know, with the 16-year-olds that are making records today versus the cats that we grew up with, you know, same with the fans. All of that. And I think, you know, I'm a firm believer, there's no such thing as good music. There's only what you love. And what you love is largely influenced by what the people around you loved, or what was playing on the radio, or where the culture was at that time. right? And so, you know, all that has an impact. So before we get into that, though, let me ask you this, both of you. When did you discover and fall in love with hip hop? Do you remember that moment or that experience?
For me, it was probably, I think it's a very thin line between the first time I was exposed to it mm-hmm. and when I fell in love with it, you know, and I wouldn't know that I was falling in love with it. I would just say
sure.
that this was something that I was digging. It probably had to be around June of 76, being on the Circle Line boat, which goes up the Hudson River. And mm-hmm. there was a guy playing music, you know, there was an actual DJ on the boat. And he kept playing Jam on the Groove, and he kept playing the drum part over and over and over again. And people were doing, you know, these little drop down to the floor, knee behind the back. I've since been told it was called the corkscrew, but we just called it breaking at the time. And that's sure. what people were doing. I didn't know what they were doing when I saw it. Like, what are they doing? It's mm-hmm. like, they're breaking. What's that? Man, that's breaking. But I liked the energy of that, you know. And then later, there was a gentleman by the name of Arnold who lived in our neighborhood who, you know, his cousin is Disco King Mario, or his distant cousin is first cousin is more or less, you know, direct to him. Mm-hmm. And Arnold came from the same area, you know, the Soundview section of the Bronx. And he's the one that brought all that information to us about, look, this is what's going on. This is what's happening and blah, blah, blah. And that's how we got, you know, exposed to it, you know, was from him bringing that information nice. To us. And, you know, I remember, you know, us being in the back of our building, you know, trying to do these dances that came out and really being enamored with these tapes that we would hear. Mm-hmm. And those tapes were generations upon a generation upon a generation. And you don't know that at that age. Right. You just know, like, I like what this is and who is that? And that's the L Brothers, you know, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. that's who we hear. Fantastic, you know, it would be Grand Wizard Theater and the Fantastic Five. It wasn't even romantic. So you would hear these things. And then, you know, eventually it was like, I want to rap too, you know, and I want to do this. And I started making pause button tapes and actually started MCing. Mm-hmm. My MC name initially was MCDC. And people's like, you don't want to be MCDC. And, you know, you want to kind of change that up a little. And so then it became Davey D. And, you know, for me, the rest is history. So I became pretty good at that.
Sure.
And I still have some of those pause button tapes. But, you know, that time period of just loving it was something that, you know, it's blur. You don't, mm-hmm. there's no one moment. I would say where hip hop became an absolute companion, you know, like, yo, this is my dog. This is, you know, I don't like to use the word, this is, it saved my life, but my family broke up. Mm-hmm. And my senior year in high school, I was pretty much, you know, back home. I stayed with my grandparents, but I was on my own and dealing with the fact that my mom, my sister, and father were no longer together, even in the same space. My mom was out here. My sister was in Florida and I was in New York. Mm. And so I was alone in that regard because it didn't happen gradually. It happened explosively. And so the companion was going to those parties, and it was that energy of hip hop and being around at that time. And as crazy as that time was in terms of not having that familial infrastructure, I wouldn't trade it for anything because it meant that I moved back to Soundview. Mm. I was around the heart of all that, you know, right across the street from the projects at its zenith when all this stuff is jumping off and all this energy, which, you know, years later you get to really, really appreciate, like, wow, I got to be a part of that ethos that was exploding. I got to see that and witness it, you know, as a fly on the wall and sometimes as a participant. So that, I think, you know, in retrospect, when I look back, and definitely when I moved out here, that was like, that's the fond memory. Like that's the, my memory to New York goes back to that last year of having that, this thing called hip hop as a constant companion, the main stable thing in my life at that time.
Sure. Sure. Mm-hmm. Jeff, what about you?
Whew. I've known Dave for a long time, longer than many people have been alive. And I'm just like, you're pulling it all out of him today, Josh. Like I haven't heard.
Yeah, man, that's great.
This is amazing. I'm going to listen to this one again for sure. You know, for me, I came to hip hop probably like a lot of other folks who didn't grow up, didn't have the blessing to, and the curse, right? Because it's both, right? To have been growing up in the Bronx as Dave did during that particular mm-hmm. period.
Sure.
That's why I look up to my big brother so much too, and how much I've learned from a man over the years. But I came to hip hop as a lot of other people did. I think pretty much like around the world. Like I'm probably closer to the experience of a hip hop fan that comes to hip hop, you know, after it gets distributed, you know, via like records like Rapper's Delight, and then the movies, that the kind of hip hop exploitation movies that come out in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And every kid at my school is like wanting to you know, be like Run DMC, and you know, people are really like taking up spray cans and mm-hmm. You know, learn how to dance like they do in the Bronx, and you know, that's sort of when, you know, the thing that Dave and them built, right, like comes out to the masses. You know, me, a kid growing up in Honolulu, Hawaii, in the middle of the Pacific, just like a kid maybe in Paris, France, who's, mm-hmm. you know, a minority kid, a North African kid, or an Arab kid is growing up and needing to find an outlet. So so that's more of my kind of thing. And it's, it's just a beautiful continuity of things.
Absolutely. Shift gears a little bit. You know, you guys have had both these amazing careers. You know, I consider it a blessing to be able to work in a space that's based around this culture that we love. And so I wonder for you guys, how much was there a game plan at the beginning, you know, as your career started taking shape? And if you look back now, like, how closely did it go according to plan? I mean, Dave, I know you started out as a rapper, so maybe things have diverged a little bit from there. But yeah, was it, you know, I, like for myself, there's been a lot of one foot in front of the other. And, you know, I've learned, I think, to become more of a planner. And the more I've had people relying on me, you know, family and staff and all that, right? My approach has gotten a little bit different, but still, you know, to some extent, I'm a little bit of a go with the flow kind of person. So what about you guys?
Well, I mean, emceeing was not a career option at all. Sure. When I came up. So
yeah,
that was something that you just did. And, you know, the context is, you got to remember, I'm one of thousands of people. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like if we talk about now, you know, like we're one of thousands of people with a podcast and one of thousands of people with an iPhone. And, you know, so it was, you know, I don't want to make it seem like, yo, man, I was putting in that work. There were elders and there were superstars. Sure. And there were people that you actually looked up to and was like, one day I'm going to be like the co-crush. Mm-hmm. You know, one day I'll be like flashing them. So those were the people blazing down the trails, and we just soaked up stuff and tried to be like them. Mm-hmm. But with that being said, you know, I came out to Cal to be an engineering major. And I was an engineering major. I was in a college of computer science and electrical engineering. And my dream at the time was to do something that now you can easily do on, you know, with a video graphics card and a computer. Sure. But at the time, I actually was in school to try and figure out how you could do a real life scale replica something that you might find akin to, you know, Grand Theft Auto, you know, when you're going through imaginary cities. But, you know, that was the dream and that was where my imagination took me. So I was out here trying to do that. My shift from emceeing to DJing came because when I moved out here, people were like, that's cool. But, you know, I'm not trying to stand around and hear you do that all day. And I didn't have access or equipment and do all that other stuff anyway. But right. I did have access, you know, to people and was, you know, and was able to start DJing. And so I morphed into that. In terms of career path, I think it was when I started doing the radio station Calyx and started doing my newsletter, you know, around that time to bring attention to the show. And the doors began to open because of the writing that was being done on those newsletters. I didn't like writing, but I figured people would read something that I had to say other than a flyer. And that's what kind of opened the doors and got me the position at KPFA. That's what made me, that was allowed me to meet Alex Mejia, who then forwarded these newsletters to the program directors at KML and got me there. That's how I met Public Enemy and, you know, and Chuck D and have that close friendship. And they opened a lot of doors. So it was those newsletters that kind of was like, wow, this is opening doors. And I can maybe see a path where I can do exactly what I enjoy doing and actually make a living out of it. And so I continued on that path and, you know, eventually, you know, gave up the idea of trying to do engineering and, you know, wound up getting out of school with a degree in social science and that whole thing. And here we are, you know, having looked back and haven't really thought about doing anything else other than what I'm doing that is based around the thing I have love for.
And I just want to say, like, the influence of Dave's charts, like playlists and stuff like that, was huge, because at that time it's impossible to kind of imagine now, but the record stores, like, if you went in there, you wouldn't know where to start. Like, if you were kind of a fan of hip hop, and I had a leg up because I worked at Calyx too. I came in a little bit, maybe Dave and I came in about the same time, but I was on a different kind of a path. Although we worked together a lot of different types of things. And but Dave's list and Dave's show was like one of a network of really, really important shows that got started around that same time. There was the drum show with Kevy Kev at KZSU. There was KPOO, which was a community station, all black station. And I want to say between Kev and Dave and KPOO, like, you got the real hip hop stuff. And then Dave was the only one to actually make a list out of it. So I'd be down there every week walking past, you know, the record store on the way to classes and stopping in and checking out, you know, oh, okay, Dave's got this up here and that kind of thing. And so I got this is a record I got to check for. And then he added these little notes, and the notes became a column in this magazine that was called the Bay Area Music Magazine, Band Magazine. And the column became a platform to talk about hip hop and politics. So I just say all that to say, like, Dave for me, like, was my model of hip hop journalism before any of our magazines that you and I were able to kind of come in and work on, you know, later on with Herb. And then before that, like The Source and, you know, other things, Rap Pages, Vibe, all these other magazines that kind of came along later. Dave was writing about the music and then also bringing in different types of factoids, like artists doing this and doing that and the kind of work that they were doing in the community and all these kinds of things. So it was super, super, super important. And, you know, like, Dave, I didn't necessarily see this. I saw it as like, this is, I love to do this. Play records. I started writing for the Calyx Station Guide. I did a story on graffiti in the Bay, which was jumping off at the time, as you remember, because you were there. You know, folks like Crayon and TWS and, you know, our man Dream, you know, like our hero Dream may rest in peace. And, you know, Bam and Estri and all my friends from Hawaii were doing the thing. And that's what I wrote about. And that gave me like the juice to kind of think, oh, maybe I can do this. But I was not on that track until much, much, much later. After having, you know, a few failed careers, including one as a small time indie hip hop mogul.
So, is that right?
Well, you know, right? Like we did the Soul Sides thing.
Yeah, I didn't think that was failed.
The artists are by no means like, you know, Blackalicious.
Yeah.
Lyrics
Shadow.
Latif.
Yeah.
And DJ Shadow, right? Of like these folks are no failures, and I hold it up, but I didn't succeed necessarily as becoming the next Diddy of indie hip hop because I just was never cut out for that. I just wasn't.
But you were before Diddy.
I mean,
I think Diddy was maybe around the same time.
The same Diddy same time 90, frame.
Diddy was 94.
City College was like, wasn't he later? Wasn't he earlier than that? Wasn't City College like 89 or 91? Not to.
Yeah, but he wasn't, whatever, he wasn't doing record stuff.
Yeah, but I don't know. Whatever.
Well, talk about that if you don't mind. That's interesting. Tell me about, you know, again, from the outside, you know, you guys made great records, important records, you know, artists that, you know, are still doing their thing to this day. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the decision to move away from, I guess it was Quantum by the time you shut it down, right?
Oh, yeah, no, it wasn't Quantum yet. We shut down Soul Sides, and then they were able to lift up Quantum. That was probably 98 or something like that. But
okay. So when you say you weren't cut out for it, what'd you learn that led you to that, and what did you learn just from the experience that you've taken with you since then?
Oh, that's a good question. These are really good questions. You know, it was a group of us trying to, you know, who are friends and trying to sort of, we just like had a passion for the music. And I think, you know, I was older than all of them, but I was still finding my way in terms of, you know, whatever so-called career and that kind of thing. I might still be trying to find my way, I guess. All these years later, I taught for many years at Stanford and mentored a lot of young folks, and people would come to me and be like, "How did you get to where you went to be? You know, where you got to be?" And I'd be like, "You don't want that. Stop that. You don't want that. You just don't want to. You don't want to go there." I don't regret a single second of any of it because it means that I'm still able to be homies with you. Like Dave and I have had this like rich and deep relationship for decades. I'm still very close. We didn't end up like a Behind the Music, you know, documentary. I'm still close to all the guys in the crew. So, so that's a beautiful thing. I would have rather had that than to have like blown up under the Soul Sides name. And everybody went on to have these really long and they're still going, amazing careers. But you know, for me, in terms of that particular moment, like, I just, you know, we maybe made some business decisions that didn't fit into the marketplace at that particular moment, and and I didn't necessarily have the skill set to be able to kind of continue to do that. Nor did I really. I'll just say this: I didn't have the fire in the belly probably to be able to do that, and that was kind of a revelation, right? And it came to me really late, you know. But it's all good because like all of the stuff that we were able to do together, you know, I took that into everything that I've done ever since. You know, the passion for hip hop and for staying up late at night and arguing about records and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, like I still have that kind of fire, right? Sure. I still have the fire to be able to kind of make sure that I'm lifting up, you know, the best of the thinkers and the artists and folks who are making beautiful things, right, in the world. And I'm able to do that in all these other kinds of ways. And certainly every bit of that experience has gone into like being a mentor and teaching, which is probably one of the things I just love most in life. So being able to pass that on
Nice.
That's probably the calling that I found after all that time.
That's cool.
You know, one of the things you learn is at a certain point, you understand that this music business is a very grimy business. And you come into it eyes wide open and you're bushy-tailed and you're doing what you do. And you go down the road a certain way. And then one day you hit a corner and you're like, you know, this is the music business.
Sure.
So, I mean, you know, being at Calyx and, you know, folks showing up one day, like, you better play our record or else. And you're like, wow, this is what this is about. And, you know, luckily we had big Nate Copeland there who was, who was like, you know, actually a correction officer at the time. So he was in uniform and, you know, and Nate was, you know, about that life. So we didn't have to deal with that at that moment, but you also started to understand that this was an industry that it got pretty grimy pretty quick.
Sure.
And you had to learn to navigate it in ways that, you know, I don't think people fully understand, you know, based upon your position. You also have, you know, depending on what side of the coin you are, people may be at a label like, get it on air, I don't care what you do. That's why you better have the stomach for it, you know, because you're walking up to somebody and they're like, sure, I'll play your record, but I need, you know, a bag of weed, a bag of coke, and, you know, two tickets to the, you know, that sort of thing. That's that grimy thing that nobody wants to talk about when it gets on particular levels in the game. And that's just one city. You know, every city got a taxation process that people have to go through. And so I think when you kind of understand that and you're able to navigate it, and more importantly, navigate it in a way where you keep your integrity and even better, don't have to go through some of those rings, that's an accomplishment. And that's also a good thing. And hopefully others are able to pick up and learn from it. I say all that to say that we're lucky that we lived in the Bay Area, where having an independent market and people who doing independent records, whether it was Soul Sides or Your Living Legends or your High Rows and so many others, your Two Shorts, is that people were able to find a path where they didn't necessarily have to go through that sort of rigmarole, you know, to the degree that you may have had to go through in other places. And, you know, and because the Bay was the Bay, it helped people find a way to get through that without having to go down these traditional doors, which oftentimes left, you know, you had a bottleneck, and you also left people either jaded or just completely, you know, upended. So, you know, here we were lucky with 3,000 miles away from a lot of that. We're in a big place, even though it seems small, but the Bay is, you know, deceptively small. It's actually a large place. And there were also a lot of markets that we were able to do things in. We had the luxury of white kids and Asian kids and Latino kids all loving hip hop. And so pretty soon the industry realized that they could sell a lot of records here. But we knew that early on. And, you know, and just seeing the brilliance of people going, I think I'll spend a week in Fairfield to sell records, and I'll go to Santa Rosa and do that, and never even having to leave the Bay to have some sort of, you know, success, is something that I'm thinking maybe people are just starting to realize how lucky they were to be in this backyard where you could do so much and not have to get really jaded and upended by having to go to other places where the stakes were high. And the goal was something that I think early on we figured, I don't need radio play. I don't need to be on TV. I don't need these types of things. I can sell 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 records here, keep the money, buy a house, and be very comfortable in a place that everybody wants to come to. If you live in the Bay, you're not trying to necessarily leave. You're like, I'm already here. So let me put my stakes down and be happy. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And look at all the stuff that came out of it, magazines, you know, projects, and a legacy that I think it stood the test of time.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great perspective. I want to take a little detour since you guys mentioned Diddy and kind of the business side. And I think, you know, as I read through the book, like it's really interesting. Like, you know, I think you have hip hop as music, you have hip hop as a cultural political movement, and you have hip hop as a cultural, as a commercial force. Right. I think in a lot of ways, you know, like everything in our world, the commercial has overshadowed some of the other things, or it does from time to time. Mm-hmm. And so as I hear you talking about that, and you know, I think it's clear that there are moments or there are people in the history of hip hop that made it what it is today, at least in terms of the economic side and the cultural side. And, you know, Diddy being one of those, you know, Russell Simmons, Suge Knight, you know, people like that who changed the game, you know, Jay and Dame, right? Who took things, you know, the reason that every kid on earth has hip hop in their ears, in their lives, in some form or fashion today is in part because of, you know, some of those people in those moments. Mm-hmm. I'm curious for you, you know, your perspective on that, and you know, you having chronicled, like, you know, all of hip hop's evolution, what are the moments that stand out to you as most pivotal?
Wow. You know, I think, you know, Sylvia Robinson, you know, recognizing what it might take, to be able to get this sort of Bronx/New York, Black New York sound, you know, to the world. This is probably the first, you know, piece. Like every time I teach, you know, hip hop history, we actually spend a little bit of time contrasting, you know, the moment, the tapes that people used to make, right, of the recordings that Dave was referring to earlier, and then to contrast that with what the early records sounded like. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were just routines that were being put to a house band, you know, kind of house funk band beat, right? Just playing the disco songs of the day. And, you know, they didn't really jump off, but Rapper's Delight being so artificial by the standards of the hip hop scene at that time, sure, you know, actually being something that somebody in like Serbia could listen to, you know,
right.
Or, you know, any part of Scandinavia or Hong Kong listen to and be like, oh, wow, that's really cool. You know, probably that's the first. And then, you know, if we had to maybe go through high moments, you know, the moment where, you know, Run DMC and Russell and Rush Charts, you know, kind of figure out, or Rush, you know, Rush Media, whatever they called themselves at the time, Rush, mm-hmm, Artist Management, figure out like, oh, we could sell Adidas shoes. Like, it's not just about selling records anymore. It's about,
right,
selling this whole thing. That's, you know, that's another kind of point. And then I think, you know, Diddy's like crucial to kind of cross that over to a broader market, where like everybody can buy into it, especially young women, mm-hmm, can it's not, this is not like a just a male thing, but this encompasses like soul, which, you know, a lot of women, you know, listen to, and that all of this attitude can be captured, and that kind of takes it to a certain other level. And you can kind of take it all the way on up to these days, and thinking about just the way that the artists have changed the game and been able to use the internet. And this is sort of where we leave the story off, right? Is how the industry like completely kind of shuts down and closes down on itself, like starts to stamp out mixtapes, starts to really like fight against the creativity that makes hip hop. Mm-hmm. And artists turn around and find a new way through their own, you know, kind of mixtapes and their direct to consumer kind of relationship, right?
Mm-hmm.
The B2C relationship, as you would learn in business school or whatever, that direct relationship becomes a way to like bring in new voices, a new generation into the space and make new sort of moguls of this all, where the artist is really centered for once and finally. And that, and what that means in terms of blackness and the way that black artists can move from being the exploited to being, you know, the folks who can dictate the terms of their careers in a stronger way than a lot of other folk. That's like the extension of our era and in industry rule 4080. There's a direct sure. line. And I think for us to kind of be able to see that arc at this particular moment is a pretty powerful thing, to kind of see the growth that's happened.
I mean, it's interesting we're having this conversation today. I don't know if you saw the news, but Kanye was announced yeah. as his net worth at $6.6 billion, making him, I think, the wealthiest black entertainer on the planet.
Yeah. You know, there's a whole thing that we could talk about with Kanye, you know.
For sure. That's his own
well,
book.
Well, what a podcast, right?
Well, no. I mean, you know. I mean, Kanye 3 years ago was on the internet, you know, on Twitter, you know, asking Mark Zuckerberg
yep.
to give him $1 million. And, you know, and he was arguing with Sway, you know, to get doors open and, mm-hmm. you know, sure. and he did it. And we can celebrate that. But I want to come back to the thing with Jeff.
Please.
Because you mentioned Diddy and all that. And I think those are success stories, and there are certain paths that they took where they, you know, blazed the trail for themselves. But at the same time, you know, I'm going to look at people like MC Hammer mm-hmm. and recognize the path that him and his brother Lewis, no you know, question. Blazed, yeah. which, you know, they're almost written out of history books mm-hmm. Because when they were doing Kentucky Fried Chicken commercials and doing endorsements, it was before anybody else, and people laughed. Yeah. When they were doing the troop outfits, right? And I'll say it, you know, they were sabotaged by competitors who put out a rumor and said that those troop outfits were owned by the Klan. Mm-hmm. And what wasn't talked about mm-hmm. was the fact that Hammer and his brother Lewis in particular had opened up 40 troop stores in malls all around the country. Mm-hmm. And so for the first time you saw, you know, you can go to a store and just buy a particular outfit. This was them. That's yeah. the area hustle, yeah. right? I'm looking at, you know, you talk about how far it could go. I'm looking at Egyptian Lover and Uncle Jam's Army and the ascension that these folks had with Mercola Records. And
definitely.
I remember Egypt talking about something on the New Music Seminar where he was asked, you know, this is the first time you're hearing West Coast artists, when he was asked about, you know, what he was going to do with his records. And he was saying, I own my stuff. This is my records. And I remember him saying something to the effect that he didn't mind if they bootlegged his records because that meant more promotion for him. Mm-hmm. So let's contrast that with some of the artists like the Crash Crew and others who were traveling around the world and finding that Sylvia Robinson, as brilliant as she was also part of an industry that was exploitative and mm-hmm. that had bootlegged their records. And mm-hmm. they were seeing albums, for you sure. know, mm-hmm. of things they didn't even know they put out. Yeah. And they're like, yo, we didn't get paid. You mm-hmm. know, so you had these fights that they were having. Whereas our West Coast counterparts, and this is not to compare and say one's better than the other, but they had the benefit of learning, and they also had the situation of not being able to depend upon an industry. So you had to really do for self. Yep. And, you know, and so seeing or remembering Greg, you know, Broussard or Egypt say, hey, man, you know, when I saw that they had bootlegged my records, this is like publicity. This is like, mm-hmm. you know, a way for me to, you know, what did he say? He said, when I heard that my records were bootleg, that meant I could do shows in that market where it was mm-hmm. selling, you know? And so,
that's absolutely
you know,
right.
figuring out how to flip that. I bring that up because that's a method that I used. You know, people were like, hey man, somebody took one of your articles off your website and they put it in the magazine. Mm-hmm. You should get paid. And it was like, well, I might be able to get paid $50, or I can just say, put my email and my website there. Sure. And now all of a sudden, instead of paying a publicist, mm-hmm. you know, to do work for me in a place like Toronto, I got a magazine in Toronto that is, you know, running my articles. In fact, run another one, do it for free. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, I get to go to Toronto, you mm-hmm. know, because people know your name. So just that understanding that we're part of an ecosystem, and it's a give and take, and it's an ebb and flow, and you know, you give a little to get a little, and seeing those moments, seeing the dance aspect show up at the San Francisco Ballet, you mm-hmm. know, was a moment mm-hmm. to me to say hip hop had come. Seeing Dominique DePrima, you know, on primetime, you know, NBC TV doing Home Turf,
yeah.
with an indication that that was, you know, hip hop was going to be, it was going to be big. Seeing I want to say if it was Jam on the Groove, you know, the off-Broadway dance thing that they had with Fable and Boogaloo Shrimp and all those folks, those were big moments, and we should uplift those and celebrate them because they blazed a path, mm-hmm. you know, that I think have almost been written out and replaced by the corporate, you know, the sure. you know, the Clive Davis, Tommy Mottola, you know, what's the guy's, Jimmy Iovine, you mm-hmm. know, their ascension. But those ascensions come, but remember, it was hip hop that saved their careers, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like they opened doors. It was more like, oh, we can make money in this arena. Right. And these folks were on their way. So I'm looking at all those different moments, you know, the independent artistry that comes out of here, mm-hmm. Looking at, somebody like Hammer, going back to him again, you know, we talk about Wu-Tang, but I remember when Hammer, you know, was offered this deal at Capitol, and it's like, hey, we got a deal. Do you have any other artists? Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, let me take Ho Frat Ho, my dancers. Let mm-hmm. me take, you know, he started taking his dancers,
sure.
which he had no plan to, and made them groups so that he could get those deals. And, you know, and then years later, you saw the Wu-Tang and others, you know, be able to build off that and take it to the next level.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's dozens of those stories. I'm sure if you go to Houston, there would be similar type of stories with Rap-A-Lot and how they emerge. And mm-hmm. if you go to Miami, you see Luke, they would see those similar stories. And of course it would be because he was taught by Egypt, you That's know, right. who went out there, and you would see it in New Orleans and in Detroit and all those little enclaves where people were basically coming off the block and trying to figure out how they can get from point A became magical moments where they saw it to themselves, like, I might be able to do something. Mm-hmm. And the trick was, was your goal to get on Broadway, to get in New York, to be on the big station, you know, in the Big Apple, or was your goal to make enough money that you could just pay your bills and maybe mm-hmm. buy a house? And in some places, people were satisfied with the independence and, right. and keeping it that way. In other places, it was like, I want to be part of this larger system. But all of those things should be celebrated. And, you know, I celebrate them at least.
Nice. Yeah,
sure.
I like that. Yeah, that was part one with Jeff Chang and Davey D. Cook, the authors of Can't Stop, Won't Stop. Order you a copy of Can't Stop, Won't Stop right now. And make sure you come back next week for part two. Join us in the Stereo app. It's stereo.com/rebelradio. We'll be hosting live conversations. You can jump in, ask questions, give your thoughts, et cetera, et cetera. We want to hear from you.